All right. Good morning, all. Such a hidden hand of God thing today, and yet today's passage is for such a time as this, chapter 4 in Esther. Kind of like our God is a planner, and like his hands aren't actually hidden. So today, we are going to be looking at Esther chapter 4. I'm not going to start by reading it today. We're going to take it in some smaller chunks. And this is going to be, well, it's Sunday school, people. Sorry. We're going to do a history lesson, a math lesson, and some other things are going to be thrown in there. But if you can have your Bibles open to Esther chapter 4, so you can follow along while I'm going through it, I think that will be really helpful. And then where I got a good chunk of my information is the Esther study by Beth Moore, and I don't know if you've ever done it or not, but she is fantastic. And it says it's for women, but I don't think it would be bad if men read it too. So just if you're like, hey, where'd she get some? Beth Moore. All right. The hidden hand of God in life and death. Now, I know that, where am I meant to point this, Jeb? It's not working. It's not on. Okay. There we go. Okay. Now, we are looking at the book of Esther, but I would like to zoom out for a second and go back a little bit farther in history to give you context about just how paramount and intense the decision is that Esther will have to make in today's story. Also, as much as this is Esther's story, she's not the main character. This is God's story. And if we just look at Esther, we miss one other huge opportunity of all of these things that God is working out in the story of Esther and uses in not just her story, in not just Susa, Persia, but in that entire area of the world. Okay? So we've got our world map up here, a little geography, the Middle East. What you are looking at is the Persian Empire. When we talk about what Xerxes ruled, it was that entire area that he had control over, that she is talking to. Okay, so the Persian Empire was a huge empire at the time. They calculate that they ruled 44% of the population that was living, lived within the Persian Empire. And Esther has the ear of that king. Okay, I want to take a little bit of a closer look. So there are three places that we're going to take a look at today. So this is a map, again, of the Persian Empire. You can kind of see the green is where it is. It goes all the way over to India. It says that he was the ruler from India to Kush, which is in Egypt area, from one side to the other, right up to Greece is where it ends. Okay, Susa is circled. That is where Esther is living and where most of the events in the story take place. But Susa is not the only place in the world. Okay, we have the rest of everything that's going on. Currently, during the story of Esther, there are also things that are going on in Judea and Jerusalem, which was part of the Persian Empire. It's not a separate entity. It was within the Persian Empire at that time. And then we have, right next to the end of the Persian Empire, the nation of Greece. And these three places play a huge role. God uses them in a really big way. Now, when we are talking about the timeline, okay, we have the book of Esther, but our Bible is not chronological. It means it doesn't follow the timeline because things that are happening in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah are also happening at the same time of Esther. It's three different perspectives going on, and Esther actually falls right in the middle of Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. And so I want to go back, and we're going to take a little bit at what Ezra and Nehemiah, well, mostly Ezra, says about what was going on. Okay, so here's the setting of our story. Here are the characters. All right. Way back in 559 BC, we have a man named Cyrus the Great. He is the one that conquers most of that land. He is still, they still have Cyrus Day in Iran today because he was like that great of a leader, known for social justice. So what had happened was before Cyrus the Great conquered all of that land, Israel had been taken over by Babylon. And they were being mistreated. Cyrus the Great comes in, takes over Babylon, and he makes a decree. He says, Israelites, you can go home. You are no longer in captivity under me. He is known as one of the first people to make moves of social justice. And not only does he send the Israelites home, he says, by the way, I've taken back from the Babylonians the things that they have stolen from your temple, and I am giving them to you to return and rebuild your altars. I want that for you. I want that for all of my people. Not a believer. He did not believe in Yahweh, but God used him to start the rebuilding of the temple. He had a wife that was well known, and she had her own court and her own system, and with it, he conquered all of that land, okay? He and his wife have two sons and a daughter and maybe more. Two sons rule for like 8 years, they die out. They're not well known in history. But his daughter, Atossa, marries Darius. Darius the Great, as he is also known, becomes king a little bit later on, 8 years after, 522 to 486 BC. Darius the Great was great because of all of the things that he did within the nation of Persia. He divided it into 127 provinces, which we hear about in the book of Esther, and he set up a postal service that allowed him to send messages from Susa to any of the 127 provinces in a week. Keep that in mind because that is important. That comes back, okay? Now, when you become a new ruler of this huge, giant empire, you don't always know the decrees that were made. And so someone in Jerusalem writes him a letter and says, hey, people are trying to stop us from building the temple. Your father-in-law said it was fine. So Darius goes back in the book of records, because they really like to read about records, and says, hey, you're right. Cyrus did make a decree that says this temple and he should be built. He writes back to the person and he says, oh, it should be built. And if anyone tries to stop people from building, they will be impaled upon a pole. So he continues to help with the building of the temple. And he says, and also because you were mean to them, you can pay for some of the temple too. And then he also takes from the royal treasury more things. So we have Cyrus sends the first wave of the people home after the Babylonians had taken them. And this falls right in line with what Jeremiah had prophesied. I mean, like, very clearly set up. Darius is like, let's keep the temple going. This sounds great. I love that. And continues to pay for it. And in Darius's lifetime, 3 years before Xerxes is born, the temple is completed in Jerusalem. Jerusalem's still this tiny little speck in the Persian Empire. It doesn't really mean a whole lot, but that doesn't mean God has forgotten it. Xerxes the Great is born in, I think it's 518, somewhere in there. Anyways, he reigns from 486 to 465. Now, Xerxes' father is Darius the Great. Xerxes' grandfather is Cyrus the Great. And so people expect really, really great things out of him, okay? He steps up to the plate, talk about a Nepo baby, has an entire Persian empire, so the land Cyrus has given him, and then the money and the organization that Darius has set up for him. Everything is set up for his success. So he really wants to set forth to prove something, to prove that maybe he's worth all of this that he's been given, okay? In Darius's last years of his reign, he wanted to go and defeat the Greeks. And so Darius set out and he tried to win a battle and he lost. So Xerxes says, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna revenge my father. And he says, let's have a banquet to celebrate the fact that I'm going to go and defeat the Greeks. An 180-day banquet where we talk about war. Sound familiar? The banquet at the start of Esther is because Xerxes is declaring war on Greece, and he is excited and ready to go, and he's rallying all of his troops, and he's trying to show just how powerful he actually is. Okay. So he's ready to go. What we have that happens, though, is at this banquet, where he's trying to be as powerful as he possibly can, right? His wife, remember, his mom was treated well by his dad, his grandma was treated well, is asked to come in front of the banquet. Now, I want to be clear. Many theologians believe that when it says Vashti was asked to come in front of all of these drunken lords with the crown upon her head, what they meant was just the crown upon her head. And that's it. So the reason why, right, Vashti is like, no, that's not how you treat women here, right, is because of what he asked. So he's all upset. He goes off to war, okay? And just to give you a sense of who this Xerxes is, on his way to war, they had to cross a river with his big giant army. And so he was like, well, let's build a floating river, a floating bridge that we can all walk across and get over there. From Greek historians, we know it's got to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. But anyways, the bridge collapses. Xerxes was so mad that the bridge collapsed that he ordered that the water under the bridge be whipped 300 times and then branded with hot irons and then immediately executed every single engineer that had anything to do with the building of the bridge. Both the Greeks and the Persians agree that, like, the bridge fell apart and he fell apart a little bit, too, and the Greeks, like to make him look a little bit more ridiculous than he might have been. They rebuild the bridge. He continues to march forward, and when they get to where they're at, remember the 300 Spartans, okay? He has a fight with them. He wins, barely, and then he continues on, and he sets up a throne on a mountaintop above where he's going to have this whole naval war against Greece. His throne was absolutely massive. Sets it up on the hill so he can sit and watch because he can't be defeated. He's basically God. He's the son of Darius the Great and the grandson of Cyrus the Great. No way that he's losing this battle. They say that he had tons and tons and tons of ships and soldiers, and Greece hardly had any, and Greece demolished them. They got stuck in this like tiny strait, and trying to get out, they rammed into each other, and the Persian ships took out other Persian ships by accident, and the ships started to sink, and most of the Persians couldn't swim and drowned, and he is sitting on the hill watching everything he has ever built crumble in front of him. And this is his first big, like, I am here. I am Xerxes the God. And immortality is not reachable for him. He realizes how mortal and small he is, and he returns back to Persia with his tail tucked between his legs and never tries to conquer anything again. He goes back to where he thinks he has power, which is within his kingdom and over the women. Okay, that's where we're at. Esther. This is not a love story. A lot of times people look at this book and say, oh, it's like Cinderella. She was picked out of everything. It's like The Bachelorette. I'm sorry. I'm going to burst some bubbles today. It's not. It is not. Okay. So we have Esther in there. Okay. So first we have Vashti, which we know she was mistreated and sent out. Okay. The king comes back and it says after his anger had subsided from losing to Greece His people are like, oh, what's going to make him happy? A bunch of young virgins will make him happy. And that is what they suggest to him. And so they begin to round this up. This wasn't a voluntary thing for women to do. It wasn't a, I volunteer as tribute, I would like to go and be with the king. No. It was officials going out and looking for girls in their young teenage years, kidnapping them, and bringing them into the palace against their will. The 12 months of beauty treatment, it's not like they were all there and like, let's gather everyone. They continued to gather people. This was a 3-year thing of gathering young women around the 127 provinces to come and be kidnapped and be in the temple, in the court. So after your 12 months of beauty treatment, which weren't about you, this isn't the beauty treatment of like making you beautiful. It's beautiful for what purpose? To please the king. At the end of your 12 months, your prize was to go in front of the king. And the king used you. You would go into his room at night. And in the morning when you came out, you were his concubine. Which meant that essentially you served him with your body the rest of your life. That's it. You weren't allowed to leave. You couldn't go get married. You couldn't fall in love. That was it. And you became part of his harem for the rest of your life. That's how he was treating these women. That is how Esther came into this situation. She was orphaned. And for some reason, she and Mordecai did not return with the other captives back to Jerusalem, so still living within exile in a nation that was not theirs, where she could not approach the altar and worship in the way of freedom, kidnapped, used, and then put into the harem, a place where intrigue continued because the women were constantly vying for position so that maybe they could have some control and some power in this place of absolute powerlessness. And yet, out of all the 127 provinces, out of all of the women that were brought in, Esther finds favor. When we left off last week, Haman and the king are drinking. That's what they do. After they have both, blasé fare, decided to annihilate an entire group of people. Sure, go ahead, Haman. Haman says, I'll pay you. And Xerxes is spending a ton of money, so he's like, yeah, that's great. Money sounds really good because I've just spent a ton of money on all of these women's beauty treatments for myself. It cost a lot. Myrrh was really expensive. That's what they were rubbed with. And they're sitting there drinking as the edict goes out. And within 7 days, because of Darius's postal service, every single 127 province knows of the annihilation of the Jews. And this includes the Jews in Jerusalem. Okay, that's where we're at. So Mordecai comes to talk to Esther. This is the beginning of chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. Here's the tidbit. Do you want to know why? Grieving wasn't allowed in the palace because it showed that the king didn't have power over life and death, and it was only meant to be a joyous place. So you weren't allowed to have sackcloth in there because it made Xerxes look bad. That's why he's outside. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Under Cyrus, they had returned. Under Darius, their temple had been built. And under Xerxes, they were to be annihilated. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He, Mordecai, also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one," "that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." When Mordecai comes and asks this of Esther, he knows that rule. This has been a rule since the time of Cyrus, okay? Lots of people tried to assassinate Cyrus. Lots of people tried to assassinate Darius. Lots of people tried to assassinate Xerxes, and in the end, they do. Yay. Okay. So, just a little picture so you can see what we're talking about. At the front, we have the king's gate. And you can actually go and still see these runes on like Google Earth today if you want. They don't look like this, but this is a rendering as to what it would have looked like. Okay? We have the king's gate, and that's where Mordecai would sit. And as Haman walked past, he didn't bow there, right? That's where that all happens. And where he is and where Hathach keeps running out to him and running back. Then we have the audience hall. That's where the banquet happened and where everyone is allowed to hang out. Okay? Through the king's gate, you have to walk through the outer courtyard and then the next courtyard, which houses all of the guards, okay? And then where the red dot is the inner courtyard. You are not allowed to walk in there without permission. When you walk into the inner courtyard, the building that's sticking up is the throne hall, and the king's throne is at the end of it. So he's sitting inside a secluded space, can look out and see who's walking around in the inner courtyard and call them forward or not. The guards were told that if anyone enters that inner courtyard, they're allowed to kill first and don't even ask questions. It doesn't matter. Just kill them. Okay? So when we are talking about this story, Esther is hanging out in her women's quarters behind the throne hall, and Hathach is running back and forth through this whole thing, relaying messages back and forth. Mordecai's at the front, and she's talking about, "That's where I can't go." So you have that picture in your mind of where they are. Okay. She responds to him, right? "You are literally asking me to go in front of this man who's been known to do crazy things, doesn't treat women super well, is living based on his emotions, literally has just decided to annihilate my people, and to trust that he's going to be in a good enough mood to talk to me. And not only that, we haven't talked for 30 days. He's got a ton of women. He doesn't need Esther, right?" That means whatever that relationship was, something had cooled, something. He just didn't care. 30 days of not talking, you might as well be forgotten with the other 400 wives and concubines that this man has. She's so far out of the loop that she would have to go and officially see him as a courtier, as a visitor, not as his wife. And the choice is, if you do that, you will die. You will perish. You will perish. Okay. Esther 4, 12 through 14. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. And these are probably the most famous words in the book of Esther. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. There are two things I want to focus on. Two balancing acts happening in this. The first balancing act is, Esther, you can act and possibly die, or you cannot act and definitely will die. Stuck between a rock and a hard place. This is not Esther's only hardship. Think about all the things she's gone through in her life. But she finally has some sort of choice. Maybe you've been stuck in a position like this, between a rock and a hard place. A sense that no matter what decision I make right now, nothing's going to turn out. There's no hope. There's very little hope. I don't know what to do. I feel alone. I can't see the end. I don't see goodness. When we were pregnant with Rose, we had to make a lot of decisions like that. Rose was born with a heart defect that she would have died if she hadn't had heart surgery within 5 days of being born. And in the moment of giving birth, the thing that kept running through my head is, if she stays inside of me, she's going to die, because you can't just keep a baby in you forever. But if I give birth, then she might die. And it was agonizing. As this train of decision, this thing that I couldn't control was happening to me, not knowing what the outcome was going to be in that situation, I felt so alone. God, where are you when it feels like my baby is going to die? She had the choice. She could die passively as a victim of a decree by an evil man, or she could die courageously trying to stop an injustice. Life is a crazy thing. It is a miracle that each one of us are here. Okay. So when you are born at conception in the first 15 days, right, your body starts as cells that just separate and regenerate and separate and continue to build. It has to happen over a billion times for your body to actually be the body that it is. And if it starts within those first 15 days, and one cell divides incorrectly, it can lead to life not happening, or like in Rose's condition, a heart that didn't develop. Before I even knew I was pregnant, that had occurred. The number of cells in your body is 10 to the 13th power. That's a 1 with 13 zeros underneath it. Okay? That's how many we all have in our body, and that had to function correctly for you to live. And yet, the birth rate is like 92%. that humans just exist. Okay, that's just our cells. DNA. For you to be who you are, right? The correct DNA from father and from mother, and that you are not your sibling, okay, is a chance of 1 in 400 quadrillion. That is, if your parents have already met, they've decided to have a children, and nothing goes wrong, and they're able to get pregnant, and they get pregnant, the chance that you are you is 1 in 400 quadrillion. That's that number. Okay. Now, not just that number, but if we add in the fact that your parents had to meet, and their parents had to meet, and they had to be born, 1 in 400 quadrillion, going back farther and farther and farther and farther, okay? The chance of you existing is 1 in 10 to the power of 2,685,000. I cannot write that number, because if I wrote that number, I would start on page one of this 3,000-page book, and it would go beyond the end of it. Talk about purpose. Talk about planned. Talk about chosen. And the chances that all of us are in this room right now together, the chance that each of us were created and that things worked out in your day-to-day life, that you ended up living here in this town, choosing Crosspoint and coming here today to hear a message about purpose, that's not coincidence. The second juxtaposition in that statement that Mordecai gave to Esther is this. Esther, maybe all of this was for a reason. Maybe you were an orphan and came into my house for this reason. Maybe Vashti was disposed for this reason. Maybe Cyrus created the Persian Empire for this reason. Maybe Darius set up the 127 provinces that included Judah for this reason. Maybe you, out of all of the women that were pulled in there over 3 years, happened to be the right age at the right time and happened to find favor with the king for just this moment. But he also lets her off the hook, and he says, you know what? If you're not going to step up courageously, though, God doesn't need you to fulfill his plans. He will find another way. But what if that way is you? So what is our purpose? Because Esther's not the only one that has life set up like a group of dominoes ready to fall for that exact moment. What are we called to? Ultimately, Jesus told us to love God and love others. And the thing is, he can accomplish that without us. But when he set up the dominoes so perfectly and says, hey, you, come here. Come watch this cool thing that I've set up over years. Come push this with me. How much more do we get to experience him and his hand and his greatness? He doesn't need you, but he invites you into his purpose and his plan. He has a place for you. He wants you to be part of it. Our God is not a God of coincidence. our chance. He is a God of planning and purpose. When I look at Rose today, that kid humbles me with her faith for God because she specifically knows, Mom, God saved me for a reason, and I have purpose. And the amount of people that I have been able to share her story with, our story with, that have impacted people was something I never would have expected. It was terrifying. It still is. Raising that kid is still terrifying. But, like, to think that I was able to be chosen to be her mom and to witness his hand in her life is such a privilege. I think we can get so caught up in the, God, why is this happening to me? Why am I in this place of pain? Why am I in this moment of hurt? Why? And we don't stop and look at, what is your purpose? What is my purpose? How do you want me to respond so that I show love to you and I show love to others? We get to see Esther's response. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. She realizes that she has a choice. She can give her life and her death and her future over to God. We don't have the word pray in there, but rarely in scripture do we not pray, not fast and not pray. So we can assume that that was there. The author very clearly took out any religious pointings in the book. She lets go of that burden of everything's on my shoulders. If I die, what's going to happen to me? And she approaches the throne of God with her problems. The throne where she has no fear. The throne that is always open. The throne that doesn't require a royal scepter because we are already his and belong to him. She starts with prayer before making this step. And not only that, she invites her community into her pain and into this moment of struggle and says, come and pray with me too. She is not alone. She seeks him first and seeks her community for strength. I think God did something amazing, though, that really helped with this. In the last chapter, we were told the date that Haman and the king wrote the decrees and sent them out. That date happens to be just about 1 week before a really big celebration in Jewish communities. It takes about a week for all of the decrees to go out and spread. And that meant that every single Jewish person on the celebration of Passover received this edict. Esther was probably preparing for Passover as she heard this news. The date chosen was cast by lots, right? They threw dice to decide. But we know that God determines how dice roll. That means that as they were getting this news about annihilation, they were getting ready to celebrate God's deliverance and faithfulness. He said, don't worry. Remember what I have already done for you. I already carried you there. I'm going to do it again. That's not coincidence. When we are in these moments of difficulty, of burden, of pain, of hardship, we need to remember truths about God. Mitch and I say something to our girls every single night that I felt like God gave me when I was really wavering in those moments with Rose. And he said to me, calls me Betsy, you are loved. I'm a God who is loving. You are never alone. I will never forsake you. And you have a purpose in every single thing. And if I remember those truths, he loves me no matter what I'm going through. He's not surprised by it. I'm not alone. I'm not walking alone. He gave us a Savior, his Son, to walk alongside us in those difficulties, in those trials. And he's in control. He's not surprised by anything that happens in your life. He's not surprised by your reaction. And so in those moments where we feel powerless, we still have a choice to make. And that response is to open our eyes and look to his face. And we're going to notice that his hand wasn't hidden at all. It was there reaching out to us the entire time, just waiting for us to come to the altar and lay down our burden and give it over to him. And in those moments where it feels like everything is stripped away, I don't know about you, but that's where I see him and feel him the most powerfully. And that's where sanctification, becoming more like him, starts. I'm going to jump away from Esther and finish my first story. 20 years later, after the book of Esther, Esther has a stepson named Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes is the last great leader of the Persian Empire. After him, it crumbles and falls. God uses this foreign nation to rebuild his temple, and Artaxerxes is talked to by Ezra, and his cupbearer, the person that he trusts the most, a Jewish man named Nehemiah, who ask him, can we go back to Jerusalem? Can we bring back another wave of people? Can we go worship at our altar? Can we build the walls to protect that relationship? And probably because of what he witnessed in his lifetime, he says, yes, with my blessing, with my army, with my money, go, build your walls. And the city's walls are built in 52 days. And they can go and they can worship at the altar. And the people of Jerusalem come back from all over that Persian Empire and return home. And they hear the word of God and their hearts return to him. And that is because Esther made a choice to approach the altar and be courageous. And that led to her whole people group being able to return to the altar as well. God wasn't done with Esther's story, and he's not done with yours. I'm going to have the worship team come on up while I pray.
And we're going to sing a song after, but I just want to open it up and say, if you have a burden, if you are facing something that is difficult right now that you want to lay at the altar while we sing that first song, it is an act of courage to stand up in front of your community and say, there is something difficult going for me, and to come forward and pray. But I would like to invite you up to the altar to lay down that burden, to turn around and see that God's hand was not hidden. It was reaching out to you the entire time. God, I pray for the people in this room. I pray for the burdens that we carry that are visible and that are hidden, the scars that are there, the pain that different people in this room might be feeling and experiencing, Lord, and I pray healing over this church and this community. And I pray that we would be people that turn to you in those times of trouble and that step forward into that purpose, knowing that you are a God who cares for us and who has planned everything down to the smallest DNA detail. Lord, I pray that we would be people that step forward and seek your face and draw others to your altar as well. May we love you and love others. In your name, amen.